Welcome to Act 2 of my chat with Jess Butterworth and Laura Donnelly live at the German Street Theatre. I can see the house lights are dimming. The audience have taken their seats. I better get back out there on stage. We start and pick up where we left off at the end of Act 1 with what actors will or won't do for Jez when he's tinkering with one of his plays in the previews of production.
Ladies and gentlemen of the Stage Door Johnny Live Company, this is your beginner's call. Mr. Cake, Ms. Donnelly, and Mr. Butterworth to the stage, please. This is your beginners.
Jez and I did a play together. His wonderful, unacknowledged classic parlor song. Not acknowledged enough is what I really mean. In New York.
Song, see?
Parlor song.
Yeah, I'm just saying, I'm always trying to write songs.
Yeah, it's true, it's true. And Jez presented us, me, with, I think, 12 different endings.
Yeah.
Throughout previews. And I think by ending 5, I was like, for fuck's sake, I can't learn another 2-page speech by tonight. And you gave me this look. And the look is this look. And the look was, are you in or are you out? Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I'll learn, I'll try it.
The reason we did that play at the Atlantic Theatre, and the reason I took it to the Atlantic first was I didn't have an ending for the play. And the Atlantic does like tons of previews before opening,
yeah.
Whereas you get 4 at the Royal
right.
Ball. And it really was swing and a miss, sitting in that flight, whatever, bar, trying to work out what the hell to do with it.
But you had to be Laura Donnelly to go, I'm not dancing, and you don't tell me to play another song on the piano.
Well, the other song, had he presented me with a great big long speech that I had to learn and, you know, before the first preview, that wouldn't have been a problem at all, because that's the whole point of that process, I think. What a new song would have taken me away from the process and would have had me just panicking 24 hours a day about getting the right notes of something. It really doesn't matter whether it's there or not.
Right.
And I wanted to be able to concentrate on the character.
Yeah. I get that.
Totally. I think it was a really interesting process for you this time. I don't think I'm giving anything away to say Laura plays 2 parts in the play. She plays a mother who inadvertently or advertently does harm to a daughter, and then she plays the daughter. And I think during the rehearsal process, you had to like start the second character halfway through, and it sort of threw you, didn't it? Because everybody else was up to speed in those scenes that she's doing, and they've been playing their character for 3-4 weeks, and she's on day 1.
Wow.
So,
I don't think you were expecting.
No, and it took me a day or two to realize why I was suddenly feeling incredibly unsure about my process. Not feeling like I was in week 4 of rehearsals, not feeling that nice, safe kind of, okay, we're getting there. Suddenly feeling like I've got no clue what I'm doing. And it's like, oh, that is because I have just begun a new character. Mm. So, yeah, it was like day 1 all over again.
Just going back to the Ferryman. What's it like, Jez? This is the first play. I mean, it's the play that Laura has in a way sort of brought you. You've fashioned this play around her real life experience, but it's the first time you're writing for her. What's that like, writing for the person you're in love with?
Laura's got this really odd quality on stage, which Sam Mendes encapsulated just the other day. He said that all actors have some secret contract with the audience that they're actors doing, and said some actors, that's a lot, and they're practically turning to the audience, and you know, and some there's just a glimpse of it, and when you glimpse it, it's delightful, it's divine, it feels like electricity. But it's kind of drawing, saying we're all here together doing this, and aren't I, you know? And Sam said that Laura's the only actor he's ever worked with who has zero contract with the audience, and I think that's true. But B, it means both when I'm writing for her, I don't see her. Whenever you're on stage, you walk on, I don't see you there either. It's something else already. Like, I've never felt nervous for Laura on the stage because she's not.
It's so true. You're sort of this extraordinary, I mean, it's beyond relaxation. Maybe it is closer to what Sam is talking about. And also, we shouldn't talk about too much about you, because you've got to go and do this tomorrow night. And there's something about talking about a production while you're in it. Laura is still and will be until June, middle of June, doing Hills of California. And this is her one day off. So this is unbelievable that she's coming here to do this. So the Ferryman, you're writing for her, but you're not thinking of her, Laura. It's only the character and knowing somehow that Laura can jump into the river and be taken by it.
So here's how precise I can be about how much Laura Ness finds its way into my writing process. I think that the subject of drama isn't life or death, that the subject of drama is dignity. We put up our dignity, first of all, by being live, being present, because it can be excruciating live performance. And so we bet some money on that. But the dignity of the actor and the dignity of the character is all going on at the same time. You know, we don't really care who wins the sword fight in the drama, but if the second somebody's dignity is at stake, everybody is plugged in. I think I told you once that I saw a man get hit by a bus in Bath in the high street and get thrown about 30 feet up the road. And he got up and pretended it hadn't happened and just sort of walked into a shop and just carried on with his life, because worse than anything would be if he speaks for itself. So Laura, I think, again, this is something I think Sam may have said, but that with every actor, you get something for free. You know, you get a thing that they can do. Some actors, you're asking, what are they thinking? And others are telling you everything they're thinking. But with Laura, the subject of Laura's craft is dignity. I think that she plays characters whose dignities are at stake the second they walk on. Mm. And so it's like I've got a palette, I've got a colour that I know that I can just paste all through the thing. And that she'll be able to do.
And Laura, what about playing Butterworth? Well, let me ask you that. How does it feel to, first of all, be trusted, I suppose, in that way, but what's it like doing his plays from the inside, so completely from the inside? What feels different about it than other people's work?
It's really easy.
Is it?
Yeah. It's really, really easy.
Do you think it's easy for everyone or just for you?
I think it's easy for most, easier for most actors than it is doing most other writing.
Yeah, I find it quite easy.
It's just, there's never a false note in the writing. You never find yourself having to sell something or make these big leaps from one moment to the next that require some kind of mental or emotional gymnastics. It's all there. We've all agreed in this cast, and I remember us all agreeing in the Ferryman cast as well. Even before, you knew you're about to go on to 3 hours, or in the Ferryman's case, 3 hours and 15 minutes of emotional turmoil. And on a Wednesday evening after you've already done a matinee, it can be like, how on earth? But we all knew all we had to do was walk on the stage. The play just carries you the rest of the way. And the writing speaks so directly to the emotion of the character. It's never somebody trying to explain how they're feeling or why they're feeling this thing. They just do something that gives you all the information about how they're feeling. And to just allow that to sit in your body gives you the emotion that you need, you get all the information you need. You get all of the emotional jolts you need. It's just all there. You just got to go and play it. It's like, I imagine, for people who are actual musicians, the difference between playing, it's kind of any average song, and then if you're very good, getting to play Beethoven, it's...
Well, this begs the question, has Butterworth ruined you?
Oh, yes. Thoroughly.
Right? I mean, that's a real... That's a
one half thoroughly. Of the coolest power couple.
That's true. That's true. Butterworth has both made you and ruined you. But I often feel this. I think it's important at this point that we compare you to Shakespeare. I often feel this about Shakespeare. I feel my life has been absolutely ruined by Shakespeare. I do. I just feel like, you can't earn a very good living doing Shakespeare all the time, much as I would like to.
Yeah.
You've got to go and do other stuff. And the trouble is, I read these scripts and I'm just like, I can't now. And there is a sort of addiction that you get, first of all, to not only the extremity of it, the depth and breadth of Jez's plays, I'm sure, but also, as you beautifully described, that ease, that there is a sort of propulsion at your back. Mm-hmm. Have you done, you've done other work, of course, in between doing the three plays together on TV and film. But have you haven't done another play?
I've done a lot of plays in between. Yeah. I did a play before the Ferryman. Am I getting this wrong? I did a play before the Ferryman. That was lovely. I wanted to get back in a theatre. At that point, we didn't know that the Ferryman was going to be a thing not that long after that. I felt the need to do some theatre again. And it was a great experience for all the reasons that doing theatre, in general is. But in terms of the writing, yeah, absolutely. It's ruined me. And I don't want to spend time away from my children and put everything, all of my energy, all of my soul. I mean, I'm barely seeing my kids right now. And to me, that is a bargain worth making every single time if what I'm doing is going into work and having the greatest time of my life. And I would still want to put all that much into anything else. That's a big cost if it's not going to deliver back everything you want it to deliver. And yeah, I find it very difficult at the moment to look around any other jobs, screen or theatre, and go, yeah, that feels like it's going to be worth it.
Cross that bridge when you come to it.
Yeah.
You were 7.5 months pregnant by the time with Alva, right? By the time you finished Ferryman? Mm-hmm. Is that right?
About 6.5, and then I did a few. Then I decided not to stop there, and I went and did a few days on a film. Oh. So I was about 7 months.
How was that, doing something so incredibly intense while you were growing a baby?
The two kind of supported each other or cancelled each other out. I'm not sure which. It was if I was feeling drained by the play, or in any way concerned or nervous or anything, any anxiety about the play. There was something that felt like I could look at it and think, well, that's more important, actually. This is this other thing that's going on here. And equally, I paid absolutely no attention to growing a baby because I was so busy going on trying to do a very good job on the stage every night. So they kind of, it's, I think each one took the pressure off the other. And I don't remember it being, apart from at the beginning when I was being sick into a bin at the side of the stage before I walked on stage, apart from that, I don't really remember being any more taxing than doing this one right now. You know, they're exhausting. You know, it's doing a very big emotional role. Just that's all that's going on.
Just to give you the timeline, Laura says she's pregnant. I write the play. We have
the baby.
The baby. You then go and act in that in the Royal Court and in the West End. And you get pregnant again in between the
Royal Court.
And
the West End. I found out I was pregnant again. And so we did. Yeah. It's definitely me. I found out I was pregnant. And I went on stage. And
we're not talking about being pregnant with a play. We're talking about actually being pregnant. Jess, you've got four daughters.
Yes.
And there are four daughters in the play you've written right now. Do you think that having children is it possible to say whether it's changed you as a writer?
Yeah, I think it has in many ways. You know, most of the first half of my life was just boys. You know, I went to a boys' school, one of four brothers, with a sister who died. Most of the voices I will have heard in the first part of my life would have been male voices. And that's completely the opposite now. It's a rare... You're the first man I've spoken to today. That's really, really common. It's just so I've just ended up the last 10 years of my life mostly in rooms with women. It's just a complete change. And so it wasn't like a conscious thing to try and write these voices. These are just I've described it for as a knock on the door and you open up and the characters are standing there. That's just who was standing there. So, yeah, I think that the fact that all of my children... of girls has been a really big part of that, because the first thing I noticed, if you've got four brothers and one girl, you know, and it's the 70s, the girl gets her own bedroom and you just hear all the voices in the room that you're in. So I didn't know until I met my four babies that there's not really that much difference between boys and girls. That's the thing that's struck me the most, is that I don't think that Belle and Gracie felt like they were anything other than just like them, and they just seemed to behave exactly like we did. And it was kind of extraordinary because I thought girls were different. Now, obviously they are, but I didn't realise how many just straight up similarities there were. Nor did I realise, by the way, if you're the only man in a room full of like six or seven women talking, how quickly they forget you're there. Which for a writer is just fantastic, because you just get to observe this behaviour, you know, and you haven't affected it.
You weren't Irish to write The Ferryman, and you're not a woman to write these characters, but does it ever occur to you to wonder how their experience is that isn't your own? Or does it feel completely natural to you to write women?
I think it must feel completely natural. It wouldn't have happened because I've never tried to write anything.
Right, I've never
sat down and gone, oh, that doesn't work. I'll only do it when I know it's gonna happen. When it's in train, it's unavoidable. I did stand back a little bit with a little bit of the Irish situation and think, am I really going to take on this many female characters? You know, like 9 or 10 or 12 or 15, however many there are in the play. But just for a moment, just sort of imagining it, that it might be difficult, but it wasn't. And so it was like I had to remember back to how I was worried about it, but by that time I'd done it.
I'm really fascinated by, I sort of feel like I've seen more and more and more as a distinguishing feature in great art, great artists. And it's this idea of a locked door, that you can go so far with an experience with somebody, but right at the end of the corridor, the door is locked. There's an element of mystery that you can't get to. And it's what keeps us wanting to walk down the corridor. That's at least my formulation. Do you think that's true of Laura? Do you see a locked door in her work?
Very much so, yeah. I think it's a really good description. And I think that the audience sees it. So you call it a locked door, question mark. It feels it's urgently important to discover that you kind of suspect you never will.
Laura, do you feel the same about Jez's work?
I'm not sure that I do, because I think it's kind of the other way around. Like, you've got to try and... I don't know, I think that it's all there, but you can keep digging and digging and you'll always find more and more layers. And that's also the joy of doing his plays over a long period of time, is because you just discover more and more and more and more. But it doesn't feel like it's a locked door so much as it's just all there. Mm. You just got to find it. Mm. It always feels like there is no end to the layers, but there's nothing locked away. It's just there for you if you want it.
You told me this great story, Jez, in our previous conversation about the day of the Queen's funeral.
Mm.
You found yourself, you were driving down to your house in Devon.
Yeah.
And you found yourself taking a wrong turn and you were back in Pewsey or going towards Pewsey, where you'd written your first play, Mojo, and which is the fictionalized village of Flintock in Jerusalem. And you found yourself sitting on the bench where one of the models for Johnny Rooster Byron had died waiting for the pub to open.
Yeah.
And you were aware that people were watching you from behind, and you turned around to find 50 people standing, staring at the TV screen as the Queen was being... It was the 2 minutes of silence.
Yeah.
And you said, what was interesting, you said, this, by the way, sounds like it might be a sort of ghost story from someone else's life. But he said, the truth is, this is just your life.
Yeah.
And you said that the things that people accuse you of being heightened or reaching for the numinous in your plays are actually, you said, just one frame on from my actual life.
It feels like that. It really does feel like that, because I didn't mean to end up in Pewsey. I was driving somewhere completely different. And I suddenly was on... I turned off the motorway at Junction 14 and I was like a salmon swimming upriver. I was going back there and I don't know why. And I was about 5 miles outside the town when I realised what I was doing.
Mm.
Listening to the funeral on the radio. And what was I doing sitting outside that pub that me and Tom, my brother, used to go to 30 years ago? At that exact moment when they're doing the 2 minute silence. It seemed really odd.
And I can testify to that, having been in his life for the last 12 years. It is. It's deceptive when you're hanging out with him.
Yeah.
Shit like that happens.
The oranges are going to wash up on the shore.
Well, no, because that was delightful, but genuinely magical stuff happens. He doesn't need to exaggerate he doesn't need to turn it into 1,000 oranges. Stuff like that happens. And it's stuff like that happens within the plays as well. You know, when you're doing his plays, events coincide in what seem like really quite mystical ways, and it is not my experience of every play I've ever done. So it's not that idea, that kind of better man off syndrome where you're, you know, of course it's on your mind and therefore these things appear. It's not that. It's unique to his plays. I mean, during The Ferryman we had moments such as in the first week of previews, one of the disappeared who were still disappeared called Seamus was found.
No.
And at one stage, an actor, Eugene O'Hare, who was in the play, was flicking through the Irish Times from a vintage copy of the Irish Times at the beginning of the play, as he did every night, and realized that there was an article about my uncle, where my granddad was speaking in there. And there's little things like that. And it's already happened on this play as well. Just little things like that happen where you think it's plugged into something else.
I chose the date of the ferryman based on when the last hunger striker died, which was on the 20th of August, 1981, which is Laura's birthday. It's the day she was born. And I didn't know that.
It was only when we had a calendar up on the set and we figured out when this would be happening. And we were like, oh, I was being born right at this time in the play.
I don't know why that stuff happens like that. But it does feel like the trip to Pusey, or that when I start writing, we were driving into our friend Neil Pepe's house in New York when we were doing The River. It threw a snowstorm, as I remember it. and just the whole story just came to me, and I told you the story, or half of the story, and then we sat up all night, and by the end of it, I think you wrote about half of it. By the end, by the morning, they had the whole story. That was where I'd gone to try and crack the ending of the Parlesong.
Right.
And I got snowed in to his house. It's like 8 foot up the windows, and I was just stuck in there trying to come up with the ending to that. To that play, and I failed, and I got it when I got back to New York. But I remember in that room, all snowed in, I kind of did the closest thing you could to meeting the devil at the crossroads and saying, I'll do anything to crack this, anything. And I think I know what it takes. It's way more than I've been putting into it, and I'll do it. And it was so odd that the next time I went there, as I'm going there, I just get delivered this entire story.
This channel that you're on is beyond, we probably shouldn't even sort of talk about it, but it's clearly evident in your plays. One of the things I love that we talked about before, but I see this in your plays all the time, it's particularly evident in The Ferryman, is this idea of a kind of theatre as a controlled emergency. The idea that you are summoning, for example, you even try and palpably create it by putting an actual baby on stage at the top of the second half, which I think was the image that you started with, your conception of the play originally, just a newborn baby on stage and an old woman and the audience are left there. This is how The Ferryman, if anyone saw it, started, the second half of which suddenly represented with a naked newborn baby. There's a real rabbit which used to pee all over the apples in the actor's pocket, so that when he had to bring out a real rabbit from his coat pocket, and then give these slightly glistening apples to these children in the production. And there was a fire at the beginning of The Ferryman. Mm. This idea that you are trying to create something in the audience's mind that feels like a kind of car crash that we're suddenly all attention for, we can't look away from. And I'm struck by that business of sort of invoking things in your plays deliberately that are off kilter, that are uncentering, that are anxiety inducing for an audience. But how is that for an actor, Laura? Does that feel, when you have to be the person putting the fire out, marshalling the rabbit, is it harder to be available to that sort of numinous accident idea than it is when you're writing it? Do actors have to be more practical?
Yes. I mean, I have a couple of moments like that in the current play where I have to make sure it comes off. And yes, absolutely. But at the same time, it's an absolute delight because I know the effect it's creating. I know that once I've made it clear to the audience, it's all right, I've got this, they're on my side. Right. And so it gives me permission, I think, to hold them in a way that is just like, whatever it is I do here will be fine. And then that in that same way then gives me permission if things do go wrong, which of course they frequently do. Yeah. I'm like, it's fine, I've got this. So it's, there's some kind of contract that gets made in those moments where I feel like I'm given permission to just be in control of whatever's going to happen here in the next few hours, or be out of control. And that's okay as well. And I really love it when things then go genuinely wrong on stage, and I have a great time with it.
Do things go wrong in
particular? So the first preview, it was a shocker.
Really?
For this one, yeah. I had an incredibly important prop that was going to be quite a large part of all of my stage business for the next half an hour of the play. And I just looked over and there it was not. And I just had to go. And that was first preview. So at that moment...
What did you do?
I just improv.
Entire tray of drinks that get served throughout the entire act. She just turns the piano. It's not there.
That's what is so exciting about those moments, because... well into a run, if something like that goes wrong, I know that I can be still saying the lines and be doing all of that, but at the same time in my brain I could be thinking, okay, well, where do I need that and what are... But to discover that I could do that in first preview then made me think, oh, this is just going to be fine. I have no problems here, because if I can stand there and be doing the whole scene to somebody but at the same time running, what am I going to need to adapt, what am I going to need to say differently, is there anything that is absolutely crucial that is going to stop, do I need to stop this right now, going, okay, no, if I need to stop it, I'll stop it in a bit, but right now we're okay. And doing all that at the same time as delivering the scene, it's just like, if I can do that, then I know I'm fine. Yeah. It's absolutely, and that that being first preview just meant, oh well, now everything is experimental after this, we can play.
And that whole thought process, because I watched it happen, was she turned to the piano and then she turned back and carried on. So that all took place in that in about a second.
But you never feel more alive. Do you realise your brain, it's that famous thing that we only use 20% of our brain. You realise you're using 120, all of the brain is going, you're like, I'm superhuman doing this. Whilst worrying. I once saw John Malkovich in a play called Burn This. He turned to where a letter was supposed to be on stage and he went, the letter's not here. And he just walked off stage and he carried on talking the entire way, and you had this sort of muffled voice in the wings while he was rummaging on the props table for the letter. But he came out, here it is. None of us cared. We just all thought this was the most exciting piece of
real emergency
that we'd seen.
Hugh Jackman split his pants open on stage of the River in New York and had to go off to the back, to the bedroom at the back and change his dress. He's just chatting away the whole time while he's doing it. People love it.
Did he really split his trousers, or did he just like, slightly like, oh, I'm just gonna weaken my trousers here. All right, we're gonna get close to our end here, and I could talk to you all night and long into the following morning about your lives together. It's 5 years from after The River that you do The Ferryman, Speedy by your standards, and then back to your usual seven until Hills of California.
Yeah,
and you come back with not one but two parts for Laura, two extraordinary parts, and I'm struck by who does this. You know,
Brian Friel.
Oh, Brian Friel.
No, not specifically that, but he does things like that all the time, doesn't he? He comes up with these devices, like in translations.
Oh, sure. But is he writing them for his missus?
No. Oh, that, no.
Yeah. No. My point is that as a sort of love, as a gift, as this life you've made over the last 12 years together, who does that? You know, here's not just one amazing part, here's two. And you then take them and just, if you haven't seen this play, please, please, please do yourself a favor and go and see it. I love Jez's plays, but it's my favorite by some distance. It's the most profound and beautiful piece. But my question, I suppose, is How is it sustainable? Can you what are you, what's it going to be now? It's going to be like a one woman show or three parts?
No. Like cats.
You'd be amazed how little we talk about it. I mean, there's just so much other stuff
you'd rather talk about.
I'll try and get her to engage, as she pointed out at the start, but she doesn't really like to.
And so it really is just there you go. And
that's kind of it, really. You know, I think Tom Waits said about working with his wife, I wash and she dries.
Right.
That's pretty much how it feels.
Right. Listen, I hope you carry on washing, drying, and smashing the crockery as much as you like for a long, 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 long time. Your collaboration is just one of the great joys of modern theatre. It really is. Ladies and gentlemen, Jez Butterworth and Laura Donnelly.
All right. There they go, ladies and gentlemen, out of the stage door, lights down on Jeff Butterworth and Laura Dimbleby, or whatever I called them, in my excitement at finishing. Thank you so much, Jez and Laura, for giving me that time and for giving us all an insight into their really remarkable lives together. I mean, who's like them? There are, of course, other couples that collaborate on making theatre or making movies or TV. But I don't know many of them in the theatre. Somebody writes the plays and the other who is the leading actor in them. It's just extraordinary. Can they keep it up? Can they keep doing it together for the rest of their lives? I hope so, because the plays they make together are just spectacular. Just spectacular. And if you can see Hills of California, please take the chance to do so. You won't be disappointed. It's an incredibly profound experience. It's the most moving play, the most interesting, the most funny, hilariously funny play, like Jez's plays always are, I think. And Laura is to die for in it. All right, thank you so much to Ben Backhouse, my producer. Thank you to the musicians, Iggy and Phoebe Cake. Thank you to the stage manager. Thank you so much to you for listening. And listen, if you've enjoyed this, and you can take a brief second to rate, review and subscribe. I'm not entirely clear what it does, but I think it stokes the pod engine somewhere crucial. I'm pretty sure it gives wind to our sails, and that's only a good thing. If you can take 2 seconds to do it, I'd be so grateful. All right, next week's guest is James Shapiro. He is dramaturg for the Public Theatre in New York, for the Royal Shakespeare Company. He's possibly the greatest Shakespeare scholar alive. He's the author of the wonderful book 1599, about a year in Shakespeare's life, when he wrote, if I think I'm right in saying, Hamlet, Julius Caesar, As You Like It, and the first draft of, the first part of Henry IV. Quite a good year for Bill Waggledagger, 1599. And Jim Shapiro is just one of the great men of the theatre. Please join me for that. Oh, and I have another Stage Door Johnny Live coming up this Sunday, March the 17th, with no less than the director of Hills of California, Sam Mendes, directed plenty of other stuff too, and his wife and the world's greatest classical trumpeter, Alison Balsam. I'm so excited to find out about her life in the theatre and on stage. All right, join me for that if you can. I think there may be one or two tickets left. Buy them at German Street Theatre. And I look forward to seeing you, one way or another.
Stage, stage, stage door, Johnny. Stage, stage, stage.